Blog Talk Radio.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Good evening and welcome to Trek Talking 2. It's Monday night. It is 7:30. We'll be live for the next hour. This is one of our cadet training episodes. This is where we go back and take a look at a classic Star Trek episode, be it from Deep Space Nine, TOS, the animated series. And we just have some fun chatting about it because a lot of those episodes, you know, are forgotten because they're so, quote, old. Well, not here. So we're going to talk about Assignment Earth this week. And before we go, let me introduce to you my Trekspurts who are joining me on this awesome podcast tonight. We'll start off, well, actually, I'm surrounded. It's the Portland crew and the Vermont guy. So we'll start off with David. Guess where David is? He's in Portland. Go figure. David, how you doing tonight?
Portland. I'm good. I actually kind of threw my back out, but, you know.
Well, you got to be careful. Well, at least you can still do Trek talking, right?
Yeah, I'm just laying in bed.
That's the important thing. And also, you'll never guess where he's from. We have Paul the Wine Guy, and take a wild, wild guess where he's from. That's right, Portland. Go figure. How you doing tonight, Paul?
Brother, I'm doing great. This is like the most sci-fi of sci-fi weeks of the calendar year, starting with today with Trek Talking 2 and ending on Saturday with Free Comic Book Day. More science fiction crammed between those days this week than anything else you can imagine. I'm super stoked.
It's mind-numbing if you think about it. It's just, it's a great
Thursday, Jim. Oh, incredible.
Oh, that's good. That's going to blow my mind. And also, my final Trekspurt, also hailing from, you guessed it, Portland, we have with us Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
Oh, you guys, I am super excited. I am like Paul. I'm freaking out over this week. I mean, it is the week of May 4th. It is the week of Picard finales. It is the week of awesome premieres. There's just a lot to talk about. And to boot, we're talking about awesome TOS episode tonight.
That's right. It's going to be a good one. We're going to be talking about Assignment Earth, which was originally aired on March 29th, 1966. It was the 26th episode of the second season. The episode that would come after this one, the next episode, was, I think, perhaps one of the best episodes ever produced in the entire history of Star Trek. And of course, I'm talking about the incredibly mind-boggling, really deep, stimulating episode of Spock's Brain. So that would be the episode after this one. So bear that in mind. It was based on a story written by Art Wallace and Gene Roddenberry. And this episode features Robert Lansing as Gary Seven, Terry Garr as Roberta Lincoln, and I think a lot of people know her as the woman from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And Barbara Babcock as the Beta 5 computer voice and Isis the cat. So this episode sets up the Enterprise goes back in time to do routine historical research. Let's start with that.
Well, I was just going to say, so it's not unlike, last week we actually reviewed one of the greatest episodes of TAS ever, which was yesteryear. Jaxley has premise, right? The crew needs to use the Guardian of Forever to go back in time to do some historical research. Here, in this case, we get the gang going back in time to do historical research because, for whatever reason, they can't exactly figure out how the planet survived desperate problems back in 1968. And so that is why they are there in the first place. And, of course, they use the light speed breakaway factor just as we saw in Star Trek IV, just as we saw in Picard. And one of y'all is going to have to help me out with the other TOS episode where they use this thing. There's another one that I can't
remember. Return to Tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul, for saving me. So it's a technique we've seen before many, many times to travel back in time. And we just show up there, though. And that's the cool thing is this is one of only two Star Trek episodes of the original series that are entirely not in the 23rd century. This one takes place entirely in the 20th century in the year 1968. So pretty cool.
It is. And I got to say, going back and rewatching, well, come on in here. Come on. Come on. Good girl. My dog is barking at the door. She wants to come in and lay at my feet while I'm doing the podcast. I thought I could sneak in, but she found me. There she is. Okay, you lay down and chew your bone, girl. So I'm going back and I'm rewatching this and I'm thinking to myself, wow, what about the temporal accords and all this other stuff? And then I'm thinking to myself, well, apparently just slingshotting around the sun is just a common thing that everybody does now. I mean, I just thought, why didn't they use the Guardian like they did in TOS? I mean, TAS. Why would they go back in time like that? The premise just didn't make sense to me at all watching it again after so many years.
Well, but Jim, you cannot view this episode through the lens of having the entirety of 55 years of Star Trek under your belt. Like when this episode came out, TAS did not exist, right? We did have the Guardian of Forever, but we didn't have with like this technique had not been used over and over again necessarily. So I thought it was kind of cool that, you know, when they first put this episode out, this was a new thing. We used this sling, or they don't even call it a slingshot. They call it the light speed breakaway factor. At that time, nobody knew what the hell that was. Like now we associate that with Star Trek IV, really, right? Because that's the first time we really get to see it. Or no, not the first time. Wait, do they show it in that episode of TOS, Paul? The one
Sorry, I got the title wrong too. After my gray matter kicked in, it's Tomorrow is Yesterday, is the one. It's the one where you go back with a test pilot whose kid is going to lead the successful like Mars probe or whatever, Saturn probe, I think it was. But yeah, they do show the breakaway. Yeah, they are approaching the sun, then pull away, and magical forces propel them in time.
And what season is that one in?
Season one.
That is a season one. Okay.
Yeah, season one. So it's before this Gary 7 episode here. But, you know, there's only one reality or one piece of continuity that really needs to be tracked as far as all this stuff goes, right? And that's the 1968 reality of Gene Roddenberry. I got an idea for a pilot spinoff, and what's the fastest way I can get this premise in front of a producer? Okay, here we go. I mean, nothing else matters, man. I mean, no one in those days for a second thought there would be the fealty to tracking reality and continuity that exists now back then. I mean, their idea of continuity was making sure that Shatner had his hair parted on the right side versus 2 days ago. They never imagined that there would be a bunch of guys on computers like 55 whatever years in the future agonizing over slingshot effects and stuff like that. I mean, Gene would be laughing. It's great. It's amazing what they spawned, man. And we're like, oh, my God, I'm never going to get through Harvard if I don't answer this question correctly.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. So you got to, like, with a lot of these episodes, like you're saying, then you have to kind of view them within the context that they were produced, right? Because if you don't, and you try and fit them too harshly into a box that does have 55 years of canon, you're probably going to get tripped up at some point and be disappointed.
Well, I don't think disappointed.
Star Wars wasn't even in the works yet when this episode aired.
Not even close.
Yeah.
No. No. Star Wars was what? 11 years off from this?
Oh, yeah, at least. Like, I think fucked up 9 years off in terms of 68. Yeah, but yeah, George is still, like, trying to pass algebra.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally bad. He's like, oh, man, I'm never going to kiss a girl. I just want to drive race cars and draw cartoons of spaceships, man. Come on.
Small correction. At the beginning of the show, you said 1965, Jim, but you're right, Paul. This episode came out in 1965. It did come out in 68, and the timing of this episode is really kind of weird, guys.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. I know exactly what you're going to say.
Yeah, because so this episode comes out in March of 68, and Gary Seven is talking about all of the things that are going to happen, right? And and one of the things that he talks about is that there will be an important assassination. And then he talks about a couple other things, like a coup in Asia, a couple other things. So this thing airs 29th of March, 1968. 6 days later, MLK is assassinated.
Hmm.
What a weird, like, coincidence of things occurring, because it is pretty clear that that assassination had a profound effect on society in general at that time. And Star Trek just happened to be there and happened to say something. Of course, they didn't predict that specific one, and they didn't, you know, there's no actual connection there, but just the timing is so serendipitous that you're kind of like, whoa.
It's uncanny. It's absolutely uncanny.
Yeah.
And this episode also predicts the predestined time paradox situation, because this is where Kirk and Spock say, well, our records do show that a missile exploded 104 miles above Earth on this date. So, so we were supposed to be here to make this happen, which creates the very first official time paradox, which we very well could be witnessing on Star Trek Picard right now.
Yeah,
I know. And it's
crazy.
And it's so weird, because at the very beginning of the episode, they went back and they said that they didn't have good records of the period. So that's why they went back to do research, because they couldn't figure out what happened in 1968. And then later on in the episode, they say that their records show something. So the way that my brain retconned that was that during that episode, you know, the timeline was changed in the way in which it needed to be changed. And so their records were actually updated on the Enterprise. There was information that wasn't there at the beginning of the episode that shows up on their records at the end of the episode. As Paul said, this is me totally just headcanoning this, because when they made this episode back in the day, none of this was in their brains.
Well, it's kind of like Sisko being Gabrielle Bell in the official records.
Yeah, no one's like, checking anyone's math, right? It's just, you know, it's like we fill in the blanks of what we think, well, it would make sense if this is the excuse, and we almost instinctively, reflexively do that, right? It's a hard thing, because you want things to make sense, right? It's the way our brains are engineered, but it's totally crazy. And what the premise of this show is funny is reminds me of, right, because they're an advanced civilization, you know, that Gary Seven is, and that they've been, you know, from what little exposition he gives us, right? They've been taking people from various planets off Earth or wherever they're from to their planet and training them for like generations, right? So they can go back and plant them there to kind of be their guardians, their watchers, if you will. And it's kind of almost reminiscent. I don't know if you remember the Next Gen episode, Who Watches the Watchers?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
It's like a proto-Vulcan planet, right, where they're still very primitive, like Bronze Age people. But the Federation scientists are in this kind of like duck blind, right, kind of like hidden away behind a holographic rock, just watching them to make sure they're okay. And it's very similar to what Gary Seven does, right? They're basically down there mostly to observe, but also if it looks like something's going to go south, they intervene, which is a really interesting twist, right? So, but really cool premise, and I would have made a great series, I think. I mean, it's really appropriate to the era, that whole late series vibe of TV, you know, with like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and shows like that. This would have been terrific. Yeah, absolutely, you know? Yeah. And I'm sorry, but Robert Lansing is just, he just exudes cool.
He had the look. He had
Man, he just has that soft whisper, that kind of Gary Cooper quality. Like, he just, you know, if a gun went off next to his head, he wouldn't even flinch. Right?
Yep.
He's just totally cool. He was great in this.
I also wondered if the, going off the idea that Paul mentioned that they need to be a series about this, is that makes me wonder if the Voyager episode, Relativity, whatever that word's called, makes me wonder if that group was the Gary 7 kind of group where they were watching time and yet, you know, they tried to keep things going around. And also I'm wondering now, also, Daniel from Enterprise might have maybe started that whole group, because they said that they're different sects, you know, sect of the time watchers, I guess you could call them, that they were just kind of like keeping an eye on making sure events play out the way they're supposed to. And so, I don't know, kind of makes me wonder.
Well, unfortunately, Enterprise got canceled, and they never really adequately wrapped up the whole temporal thing with who the guy was and really Daniel. They never got to really adequately finish that. Yeah. So I guess we'll never really know. But listen, we got to take our first break here, guys. And in preparation for Thursday night's premiere of Star Trek Strange New Worlds, we just heard the original opening sequence with, of course, William Shatner doing the narration. Now that Anson Mount is stepping into the role of Captain Pike, I wonder if he's going to read his own little narration. Well, why don't you take a listen and decide for yourself what you think. Here is the opening sequence for Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which you will see Thursday on Paramount Plus.
Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission. To explore strange new worlds. To seek out new life and new civilizations. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
And that sound you heard was my head popping. I'm just totally just
yeah, a little bit. Do you need the mop, Uncle Jim? Do you need me to bring the mop
in? This, what a great time to be a Star Trek fan. I gotta say, it's the golden age of Star Trek. So before we took our break, we were talking about Star Trek Enterprise and the temporal time accords, the temporal time police. You know, there was all kinds of things that were brought up on Enterprise, but never really. They didn't get a chance to wrap up those storylines because it was canceled. But Eric has something to talk to us about.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that we're not, so to speak, crossing our streams on this one. So I think we might actually have
crossing the streams is very bad.
Yeah.
I remember that from Ghostbusters. It's very bad.
So we might actually have two groups here, guys, and I'm not, like, to me, it's not entirely clear. So So David brought up the Voyager episode Future's End, part two, where the USS Relativity shows up, and they bring up the Temporal Integrity Commission, which is a group that is supposedly in charge of making sure the timeline goes the way it's supposed to go. Okay, so that is one group and kind of one set of goals that's happening in terms of keeping track of the timeline. Then in Enterprise, we have Daniels and the Temporal Agents and the Temporal Cold War. In that context, Daniels is not a guy who's tasked with the keeping everything the way that it's supposed to be. He's actually tasked with entirely different things, with making sure that this war is waged in a particular way that it doesn't completely destroy the universe. So I just want to be careful that it's not like Daniels and those gang from Enterprise are necessarily part of the same group of people that Gary Seven's from. And Gary Seven may or may not be part of the same group that shows up in Voyager. I'm more inclined to think that he's part of that group, or that that group is actually part of his group, obviously, because he came first. But I think that folks from Enterprise are maybe outside that a little bit, because the Temporal Cold War is people trying to change the timeline to make things different. And so Daniels is a different entity in that.
And you also have the Temporal Investigations from Deep Space Nine, too.
Correct.
Yes.
And those guys are more, I think, part of that Temporal Integrity Commission, that first part that I was talking about that show up in Voyager. I think they're part of DS9, too. They haven't, like, what the thing is they haven't, Star Trek hasn't really connected all of these temporal things together in any way. Like, they haven't actually told us that these are the same commissions or that they come from the same place. This is all super headcanon right now and just us supposing what might be true.
And nor would they want to, because it would really limit them in terms of, like, you know, what people would want to come up with for new stories and to write stuff. If you start painting, you know, a bunch of dotted lines down the middle of the highway, all of a sudden you kind of only have to drive on one side of it, right? I mean, they want to be able to leave things a little loose and free to experiment with future franchises we haven't even thought of yet.
And it makes these conversations more fun, right? Because we can headcanon a bunch of crap that maybe isn't true.
we're
I think it's all run by Tribble.
Yeah, and we can do that.
Of course you do. David's on the Tribbles. I love it.
But, one of the things I was reading up on this episode a little bit, and I know that Terry Garr, who, of course, was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, one of the biggest movies that hit the pike in the 70s, great Steven Spielberg movie. In fact, they referenced it on Discovery, actually, with the five notes, which immediately is dun, 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 dun. Everyone knows that. At any rate, Terry Garr said that she absolutely had the worst time of her life filming Star Trek. She said that Gene Roddenberry was constantly trying to shorten the seams on her dresses to the point where it was uncomfortable for her. She won't talk about Star Trek. She won't reference Star Trek, wants nothing to do with it whatsoever. It was such a terrible experience for her. But she was great in the episode. I thought she was perfect in that role. So
yeah, I mean, she's an interesting character to me, because she kind of shows up as the – well, she definitely shows up as a person who doesn't have any clue what's going on. Like, she doesn't know that she's been under the employ of two of Gary Seven's agent, which I'll just say later, we're going to talk about his agency in particular. I will give it a name later, but she has no clue that she's actually been working for these people for a while. And what's amazing to me about this episode is she does seem to kind of like play it off pretty well. Like she shows up a little bit as the kind of like dumb secretary, but then she realizes at some point that this guy might be nefarious and does try to take over, there's a little bit of kind of like I don't think she's really that successful trying to prevent Gary Seven from doing anything that he's doing. And those are a couple of the weak spots that I think happen in this episode. But she is a really compelling character that for some reason I love to watch.
She was great.
Yeah, I mean, on the page as written, right? I can see why she probably, you know, felt bad, because it's the late 60s, right? Where it's not exactly a banner era of feminism, right? And
no.
Basically, she's cast to be the ditzy blonde. I mean, how unappealing is that if you happen to be female, right? Where back then there was very little respect given you at all. So of course she probably had a miserable time if all they can focus on is, hey, how much more of your thigh can we see, right? But the great thing is you could have Terry Garr read the phone book and she's funny.
Right.
I mean, you know, look at her in Young Frankenstein, right? One of the great comedies of all time in cinema.
So
she's phenomenal, man. So she's great. I mean, I think there's on the page what you see that they gave her to work with, which is like nothing, and what you get on screen because she's so funny and talented, which is everything, right? I mean, she's just fantastic. So she brought a ton to this, but you can imagine from her perspective, you know, of a intelligent woman in the late 60s, she was probably like, get me out of here. All these guys want to do is see my crotch. Come out.
Exactly.
Now, here's an interesting thought, because her almost had the exact same problem, almost left the show, but turned out that Martin Luther King actually convinced her to stay. So would the roles be reversed if somebody had convinced Cary Grant to stay? You know, that would have been an interesting thought.
Yeah. I mean, we'll never know, because she just won't talk about Star Trek at all. Doesn't care.
Well, she can't talk about it now because she's dead.
Yeah. And those are very, very different scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, you never know. I mean, they're, you know, they're trying to get
into
Elvis all the time. So, you know. But at any rate, the episode was enjoyable, and it actually does tie into Picard, because Talon is of the same agency that Gary Seven is from, which is cool.
And Jim, is that
the only weird thing about it that I didn't catch was why was she a Romulan? Why'd they take a Romulan? Why didn't they grab someone from Earth? Why was it a Romulan? I don't know if they made that clear or I missed it.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Jim, if you remember back, So this is now a good time to bring up what I consider, if you're going to watch this episode, the canon adjacent source that I feel like you absolutely need to tap is the Star Trek Year 5 comic book, issue number 17. And that one in particular, illustrated by our good friend J.K. Woodward and beautifully painted every single panel, gives you the entire story of Gary Seven. And where his agency comes from, how he, works his way into the agency, who these people are. It gives you a whole backstory that you do not get in this episode that I think is just absolutely fascinating. Right, Jim? I mean, you remember reading that before?
I believe Kirsten Byers and Mike Johnson were involved in that too.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely are involved in the Year 5 series. This particular issue was written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, and of course, illustrated, like I said, by J.K. Woodward. But yeah, what an interesting backstory to the whole Gary Seven genre? I guess that's not the right word. I can't think of the
mythos.
Right.
But the Gary
mythos.
Seven
there
mythos.
We go. Mythos. That is a great word.
I think what you're seeing is something we've talked about on Comic Corner and Book Nook in the past, and that is that Star Trek is finally weaving the books and the comic books, the TV shows and the movies into one cohesive universe, like Marvel's doing with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where, you know, I used to read the pocketbooks back in the 80s, but it got to the point where they were just got ridiculous and I just didn't care anymore. And, you know, because an author would just come up with an idea and run with it, and it would have absolutely nothing to do with anything. It was just what they wanted to do with the character. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. If you read the Discovery books, they read like an episode. They read like they could fit right in between this episode and that episode. They're beautifully crafted. Same thing with the comic books, just like Eric is talking about. If you read the IDW stuff, and particularly, you think it was a coincidence that we got this whole Gary Seven thing and we got the whole Q conflict thing And who shows up on Picard? Gary Seven's protege, or whatever you want to call her, and Q.
Yeah.
Coincidence?
Yeah.
I think not. I think that they're starting to weave these things together so that if you're reading all this media, which we do, it just flows right into the show. And I think that's great, personally.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that we're seeing a lot of other examples of that too, right? It's like over on the other side of the genre fence in Star Wars land, right? It was a lot of similar chaotic things where there's all this different stuff. And ever since folks got involved on, like, say, the Disney series, right, like The Mandalorian and things like that, they started pulling in more expanded universe stuff from the comics and things like that. That before, people were like, it's not really canon, and da-da-da-da-da, but now they're bringing some of that stuff on board and kind of tying things together and incorporating it, expanding the universe. And the fans have been loving it because it makes a richer tapestry to tell stories. So I think you're seeing a lot of that same stuff here.
And Paul, my like philosophical, like societal reason that is occurring is that people no longer really have to remember things. We live in an age where everybody carries literally the Encyclopedia Britannica in their pocket, right? Or excuse me, the Encyclopedia Galactica, an even better reference, right? In their pocket. Like,
is this why I'm so forgetful? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Don't panic, man. Don't panic. But, like, you can literally look up every single reference that human knowledge can possibly give you in your pocket. And so we don't really have to, like, remember stuff anymore. And so to me, the depth that we see in shows these days is an absolute outgrowth of the fact that now we just look stuff up. And when we look stuff up, we think about it and we ruminate on it, and it's actually an expression of artistic depth to me, right? Like the fact that we try and headcanon all this stuff. I mean, it was one thing to headcanon everything back in the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s or 2000s. It's another thing, I think, to headcanon things in the age of the internet, because now we can talk about it. Now we can all like come up with our own crazy ideas and throw them out in the internet and get pissed at each other about it. And, you know, all of that stuff that we love to do. And it necessitates that the art that we make now have more depth than it used to have back in the day.
What was the name of that awesome discovery book that we read that had Lorca, Prime Lorca, the only time we ever see Prime Lorca? What was the name? Because I mess up the titles every time we bring it up, so I'm going to let you mess it up. What was that one?
Well, Jim, I understand drastic. The problem. It's Drastic Measures is the one.
Yes.
Yes.
Drastic Measures.
Drastic
was a
Measures
phenomenal,
is very good.
Outstanding book, and the reason why I'm bringing it up is twofold. We had the author of the book on our podcast, Dayton Ward, was it?
Dayton Ward, yes. Yeah.
And at the end of the book, there's a two or a three page epilogue at the end.
After
everything is done, the whole story's over, everything's finished, it's done. If you don't, it's like sitting to the end of the credits in a Marvel movie.
Turn the podcast off now if you don't want to know.
This book is, this is an old book. Anyways, at the end, there's like three pages of what happened to Prime Lorca. And we asked him on the podcast why the story was over. Why did you put that in there? And he told us on the podcast, you guys can go back and listen to it, that Christian Beyer and the producers of Discovery wanted that in there. They wanted everybody to know that Prime Lorca
is alive.
Not dead.
That's right.
So take that for what
like you can't really foreshadow better than that.
Yeah, so take that for what it's worth. But also, the reason why I bring that book up too is who was the captain of the ship that comes and rescues them and the planet. It was Captain April.
Yep.
And now we're seeing Captain April. We're going to see Captain April on Thursday's episode of Strange New Worlds. So everything that they do, they do for a reason. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Nothing is an accident. Nothing is a coincidence. And you know, they're planning everything out years and years before we even know about it, which I think is great.
I think that's a good point, Jim, and I just would like to give kudos to that, I think, because I think a lot of people feel like the people running the Star Trek franchise right now don't know what they're doing. And I just want to say that I feel like they really do put a lot of thought into it. And do they always hit the nail on the head? No. But they are really thinking about it in a 21st century context and really trying to piece all of these things together. And the fact that the different teams from the different media, like television, comics, books, all of that kind of stuff, are actually crossing over, that's unprecedented. And I just do think that's a very special aspect of this golden age of Star Trek we're in.
And I think that Paul hit it on the head before. You know, in the 60s when they wrote Star Trek, they had no idea that 56 years later, we'd be on a podcast talking of, well, they didn't even know what a podcast was. But then we'd be sitting around talking to a global community on a radio show that's broadcast around the world about what they did in the 60s. So
there wasn't even any syndication back then. It's like when the episode ended on like Thursday night or whatever, as far as they knew, it was forgotten to history. Maybe it would repeat, but there wasn't even any idea of reruns at that point, right? I mean, they were like, the idea that, you know, that people would be, you know, the guys who wrote this stuff, you know, for the most part, they're like, it's a paycheck, right? They're like, okay, I was able to write this one extra episode about immortal, you know, bat people or whatever, right? And it's just then right. done. And they're like, oh, but the idea that people would be dressing up in the characters that they wrote in the 60s at conventions, I mean, that's just like, your head explodes. It's crazy. But it's just, what a tribute, though, to, I think, a couple things, right? It really shows that this universe, which we all pay homage to a couple times a week together, is just so enduring and touches so many people because of that core of imagination to it. And what a tribute to the affection of the audience that they have just for generations and generations, grandparents and their grandkids are still connecting with this stuff. And it becomes an enduring mythology. We keep digging back into pretty freaking amazing.
You have to take it for what it is, basically. It's not the Holy Bible of Star Trek, and they're trying the best they can to make all the shows that they're making now fit into the world. So they all work together. And sometimes, just sometimes, something that happened or something that was said or something that was done on a previous show 45 years ago or 50 years ago might not exactly fit perfect with what they're trying to do today, doesn't mean you throw your arms up and scream, they violated canon, I'm not going to watch it, it's terrible, they broke canon. You can't be that dogmatic about it.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Amen. Yeah. That's very wise words there, my friend. Very wise words.
You just can't.
You know, scrap a great idea because of one little nitpick thing. Right.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, it's just like, how good is the story? If it's a good story, tell the story. And you know, if you want to go and list it, there's a billion inconsistencies throughout any fictional universe, right? The Marvel universe, where people go crazy. Star Wars. I mean, all of these things, there's a million inconsistencies. And if you are looking to spend time doing that, I mean, you could do that, but is that a really satisfying way to engage as a fan? I'm going to say no. Not at all. Not for me. I think it's fun to look at the stuff that overlapped within the episodes, right? Because remember, it was like a relatively cheap TV show, right, during the 60s. And if you look at Gary Seven's computer, right, Gary Seven's monitor, right, that in his apartment, that round monitor, you see that in like at least two other episodes, right, of the original series. It's when in The Ultimate Computer, when, Dr. Daystrom hijacks the Enterprise, this great computer. It's the same computer interface that he installs down there in engineering, right? And then that kind of zany time travel episode back in season three, All Our Yesterdays, with Mr. Atoz, right? And he has the library. You can walk through the little thing and go off to, like, Arctic planets or whatever. And Mr. Atoz has the same computer. So there's all kinds of funny stuff like that. In Assignment Earth, this episode, the two cops who you see, right, when they get they come to the door, right, and they're right. Like, hey, we heard this shooting, what's going on, right, and that whole thing, these two New York cops. One of them is the actor who played from Shore Leave, Finnegan. Remember Finnegan, the one who used to taunt? Yeah, he used to taunt Kirk at the Academy, and it's totally Finnegan, man. But it's just like he's got a walk-on. He's like, oh, yeah, $50 for a walk-on, no dialogue, I'll take it. But it's just hysterical because it's just all backlot stuff like that. I just love that. To me, I would rather spend time noticing those things that are in common and those similarities and those little overlaps than start, you know, futzing around over what, you know, connective tissue I imagine should make sense doesn't. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Well, listen, guys, don't touch that dial. We're going to take our final commercial break of the evening, and when we're back, we're going to keep talking about Assignment Earth.
Trek Talking, all things Star Trek and beyond. Thursday night, 7:30 to 9:30, all hailing frequencies are open. iTunes, iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon, and wherever fine podcasts are found. Trek Talking, boldly going wherever your mind is willing to go.
And we're back. So let's talk a little bit about the episode itself and the pacing of the episode and the way it goes through. So, you know, Scotty's on the Enterprise, and he's trying to find Gary Seven, and he's bouncing a signal off of a satellite. And he's getting these shots of a rocket from space. And it's like, well, how do you expect, do you think he's going to be waving a flag saying, hey, Scotty, I'm right here. But eventually he finds him. And, you know, the rest of the episode unfolds after that. But when Kirk and Spock go to the office, and Roberta Lincoln is in the office, and they have the little tuffle. Spock is wearing a wool hat, which seems to be, to me, the ultimate Star Trek trope, because every time we have an alien, usually it's a Vulcan, but it has been known to be a Romulan, they put a wool hat on them. They did it on Enterprise. They did it in TOS. What, this was, what, the third time that Spock wore a wool hat to cover his ears?
City on the Edge of Forever.
City on the Edge of Forever, he did it, yep. So that seems to be, well, in Star Trek IV, he tore off his bathrobe and tied it around his head. But it seems to be throw a wool hat
We've
on
all done
him.
That,
it's
Jim.
Like one of those
We've
tropes,
all done that.
You know. But, you know, when Kirk and Spock are in the office and Spock is trying to take control of the rocket, and Kirk was like, I don't know who I should trust. And he's doing his thing. And Spock says something like, what? It's an emotional decision that you'll have to make based on.
No,
your...
he says you have to, he says the logic of the situation doesn't, like, there's no solution based on the logic and the knowledge that we have. So he has to rely on intuition, human intuition.
Yeah. Yes. Something along those lines.
What feels right, the right thing to do.
Well, and I mean, that's, so to me, that's just like, that plays right into something that we see in Star Trek all the time, right? We see many, many times, and I feel like they develop it even later, like, you know, Wrath of Khan and like other stuff later on. But we learn that the Vulcan logic has limitations, and that the best balance that we can strike is to take advantage of each other's, you know, things that we're good at. So, you know, Kirk is at his best when he takes advantage of Spock's logic, and Spock is at his best when he takes advantage of Kirk's logic. And so this was just another one of those moments where Spock's like, listen, dude, I don't really know what to do based on logic. You're just going to have to give it a gut call and see what happens. And all along, Kirk has kind of had this gut thing going. But to me, the gut thing kind of flip-flops in this episode. Like, the entire episode, Kirk spends his time distrusting Gary Seven. And Gary Seven doesn't really give him a compelling, like a super compelling argument. Like, right in the end, he's basically like, listen, either you do it this way and everybody dies, or you do it this way and everybody doesn't die. And Kirk's like, yeah, okay, I'll try it this way. You know, there's no like super compelling reason that he feels like he actually needs to listen to Gary Seven.
Well, yeah,
about the only other way
episode, so that the pilot episode
kind of
would get approved.
To him a little bit though, Eric, where he does kind of say, he goes, he kind of, you know, does devil's advocate with Kirk. He's like, would a really advanced civilization come here and do their thing? No, they would like, they would do it on the QT and they would send people in, and he kind of like, you know, kind of reassures him that, you know, that there's like a higher, more advanced methodology behind here, which I think kind of sells it to some degree. It's not like evidential as much, but it certainly, you know, I think it kind of makes him go, okay, wait a minute. This guy seems like he's not just, you know, up to nefarious means. He's, you know, I think it,
yeah,
makes
sure.
You trust him a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. And I'll just,
now I'm headcanoning.
Right. And I'll just comment that, like, one of my favorite things about this episode is that they use a bunch of really cool stock footage from back in the 60s of Saturn V rocket and the thing sitting on the launch pad. Because you have to realize, guys, that, like, that's the rocket that took us to the moon, right? And when they show all of those overhead views and aerial things of the Saturn V rocket, those are all taken from NASA planes and things that they used, and they were able to actually buy that footage and integrate it into this episode. So we get images from the Saturn V rocket used to carry Apollo 4 and Apollo 6, which I think is really special. And it's not, you know, it's fairly well integrated. It's better integrated than the cage is integrated into the menagerie, you know?
Did Spock try to Vulcan nerve pinch Gary Seven in this episode?
Yes.
And it didn't work.
He did.
Am I remembering the right episode?
Yes.
Because my brain is,
Gary,
you know,
Seven, in that first battle that he goes through, Gary Seven resists a neck pinch by Spock and takes out 3 red shirts. Boom. No problem.
Wow. And he's got that Doctor Who type sonic screwdriver pen thing.
The sonic. He's got the sonic, and I will tell you that in
the servo.
Is that what they call it? The servo?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Pretty
well,
sure.
I missed that. I was like, I rewatched the episode. I was trying to find in all my notes, it's called the sonic because I couldn't help myself. But yeah, to me, that thing is very much like a sonic screwdriver, right? It's in charge of, which he does many, many times in this episode, but it goes beyond that because he's actually able to, I think what it is make people very suggestible. So he basically zaps them. They get this kind of like look of bliss on their face. And then he says, go to sleep. And they go to sleep. And that happens to at least 2 different people in this episode.
Yeah. You go take a little nap.
That's right.
It's kind of like the Men in Black thing that you stare into.
Poof. Well, and that was the thing, was I wondered if it actually did do a memory erase thing, because that's not entirely clear. I personally think it's hilarious when the one guard dude is put to sleep, and then right when he wakes up in this episode is when Spock and Kirk beam in. So that guy is like, he's got some serious PTSD from this episode.
And let's not forget about Isis the cat.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk about her a little bit because, yeah, she.
I gotta throw out an ISIS credit for you, man. Just because at the beginning, I just gotta make sure everybody gets their due on ISIS, because you were talking about Barbara Babcock, right? Who did the voice of the Beta 5
right.
computer, right?
Yeah.
Well, she did the voice work for ISIS, believe it or not, right? They were trying to make these cat sounds and they couldn't find anything that worked correctly, right? And she's like, oh, I can do that, yeah. And so she actually is the one who did like the cat sounds, is Barbara Babcock, because she did a lot of voice work, right? It was a totally different actress who played named April Tatro, who was like a, you know, vivacious actress from the late 60s, did a lot of soap opera stuff, but she's the one who plays Isis in her human form. So I know she got incorrectly identified for a lot of years. So just got to make sure everybody gets their Isis cred, right?
Well, in the comic book series that Eric was talking about, Isis actually has a much larger role than just Gary Seven's pet cat.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so you know, I highly recommend, if you guys are looking for some background information for this episode and for Star Trek Picard, you've got to go and check out the IDW Year 5 stuff, because Isis is a much bigger character than you might think.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and
it's very cool.
I'll say issues 11 through the end are the ones that actually include some Gary Seven stuff and some Isis stuff. And I will not reveal anything because I want people to go out and read it. But let's just say that Isis may be even more than she seems from what we've seen in Assignment Earth. There's one layer, person. There's two layers, cat. There may or may not be a third layer.
Wow. Onion. The
mm-hmm.
onion of Isis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So check it out. We review them on Comic Book Corner. But you guys, if you're looking for some stuff, like I said, the comic books and the novels really tie in well to what you see on the screen. So if you're looking for some backstory, check it out, because you won't be disappointed. Same thing with Discovery and the whole Klingon thing. There were some great comic books that dealt with the Klingons and filled in a lot of stuff about Takuma and what was going on with the time crystals and stuff like that were not featured in the show, but the comic book really fleshed them out really, really well.
Cool.
So Light of Kalas, yeah. I think, was the name of it.
Yeah, Light of Kalas was the most excellent series about the Klingons, but there are some awesome, like there's a great series called Succession that is the follow-up to the Michael Burnham Mirror Universe story. So you get to find out what happens in the Mirror Universe that you don't find out on Discovery, which is pretty cool. Like, what happens when Giorgio leaves and the Emperor, there's suddenly this like huge power vacuum where the Emperor used to be. Cool political things happen.
And there also was a story with Captain Pike and Laurel.
Yes, there was. There was a very excellent story involved in there. Jim's just hitting the nail on the head. I can't recommend the recent Star Trek comics. I'd say anything put out in the last, since Discovery came out. So the last 5 years or so has been absolutely stellar. I mean, there have been a couple issues here and there that were like, eh. The Year 5 series in particular, though, if you're going to read Star Trek comics and only pick one series, that's the one I would read, because it's so good. The writing is so good.
Yeah, they're enjoyable. They're really, really good. I can't recommend them enough. But getting back to Assignment Earth, I thought it was a very fun episode. It didn't have the moral subplot that a lot of Star Trek had. It was more of a fun rompy type of a story, and highly enjoyable, I felt.
And he's a secret agent. I think that's one of the things why it's such a cool late 60s show, because this is the heyday of the Bond pictures, right? When Sean Connery dominated the planet. And he is basically a outer space secret agent, is what Gary Seven is all about. And it's that coolness factor that I think continues to make this a really fun, really engaging story that people always put in their top 25 episodes. And so if you're listening, Playmates Toys, we've always wanted a Gary Seven action figure with Isis, and it would be, you know, I mean, come on, a little love here for the classics would be fantastic. And one thing I did want to mention just before, I didn't want this to fall apart just because I think it fits on the same shelf, just mention it real quick, is the whole idea of this being a failed pilot. Right. And if you're a Gene Roddenberry fan, I don't know if everybody's gotten a chance to see all these, but there in the early 70s, there was a whole gaggle of these pilot movies that Gene wrote and put up that you know, were actually pretty entertaining. But they were all done as like pilots to become series that never became series. There was one called The Quester Tapes that I'm guessing a lot of old fans may have heard of. Have you ever seen that, Eric?
I have not seen the Quester Tapes, no.
Yeah, it's about the idea of, like, it's kind of, you can tie it back to Next Gen and Dr. Soong, really, because it's about this scientist and him creating the first accurate android, essentially, right? Quester tapes is like the beginning building block template for where they would eventually go to explore the Data character. Came right out of there. He did a Supernatural series show called Spectre that's very much like Doctor Strange in a lot of ways, with paranormal detectives, and then two kind of dystopian sci-fi thriller shows. Like, one was called Genesis 2 and one was called Planet Earth. But if you like Assignment Earth, and you like the whole idea of, like, oh, this is like, you know, building blocks to kind of launch off, and you can picture a whole bunch of different stories. All of these are available on, like, CBS Home Video. They, like, make them super easy to find. I think a lot of them are on one disc where you can just get them and watch them and stuff. And they're a little goofy because they're dated in some ways, right? It's that 70s vibe to it. But they're wonderfully entertaining, and they all scream Gene Roddenberry's ethos in terms of the writing on there, because he wrote all of them and they really feel like Gene. So check them out if you are a fan of this episode and you've never seen them. Track them down. They definitely belong on the same shelf as Gary Seven.
Genesis 2 was awesome. I liked Genesis 2. I thought that was decent.
Ah,
it was
cool,
kind of like a Planet of the Apes type of a thing, but without the apes. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he did a bunch of those, and they're really fun.
So, yeah, so I just want to say that Futurism, I don't know what magazine that is, but Futurism ranked Assignment Earth as one of the best second-tier original series episodes. I don't know what that means, second-tier.
I think they mean one that's not focused around the big three and some sort of, like, interesting plot about that. So they're saying, like, you know, we took ourselves outside of what we normally see on Star Trek. What's the best of that?
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I could see that. So Assignment Earth never got picked up. We never got to see the further adventures of Gary Seven. But we do get to see Talon One. I don't know. Or is she Talon 7?
Well, we know she's a supervisor, but we don't know how long she's been around. And you find out in the comics why Gary 7 is number 7 as opposed to, like, number 6 or 5 or whatever. So who knows what Talon is?
Yeah, we don't know. Maybe we'll find out on Thursday, although I don't think so. But, yeah.
I think
so
Romulan.
Just another Romulan, yeah. I wonder if she's related to the Mo guy from Carbon Creek who's running around on Earth somewhere. We'll have to ask Eduardo Roman that on Monday when he's on Trek Talking too. That's right, guys. That's right. You thought that I slipped that in there and made a mistake? Oh, no. We've got a great, great show planned for you next Monday. Same bad time, same bad channel. We're going to have Eduardo Roman on, and he is the mind-meld Vulcan from Star Trek Picard's episode Mercy. He's the Vulcan that mind-melds,
tries to mind-meld. Yeah.
Yeah. And then beams away before the mind-meld completely takes form. And we're going to have him here on the podcast live on Monday night. You guys can give us a call at 646-668-2433 and talk to Eduardo Roman yourself. Ask him your questions. We're going to have a lot of fun hanging out and chatting with him. So you want to check that out on Monday night. Thursday night is the premiere of Strange New Worlds and the season finale of Picard, as if that's not enough. But we won't be talking about either of those two events on Thursday night. We will be talking about the Hide and Seek episode, which was episode 9 of Star Trek Picard. We won't be covering the finale and Strange New World until the following Thursday. We're a week behind. It gives our international listeners a chance to catch up and participate in the podcast. So that's
because
what's
we respect
going on
NATO.
With Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's going on with Trek Talking. And I want to take an opportunity to say thank you to my Trekspert, and they're all from Portland. Except for me, I'm all alone up here in New England. But we want to say thank you so much to David for hanging out and Trek talking with us tonight. Thank you so much, David.
You're very welcome.
And we definitely want to say thank you to Paul, the wine guy. Thanks a lot, Paul. Oh, and thank you for doing our special Strange New Worlds intro show with me that we threw together in 6 minutes last
That was fun, man. Are you
Monday?
Kidding? Yeah, that was Friday. That was Friday afternoon. That was crazy.
Just got to throw it together.
And you know, Uncle Jim, I think David and Eric and I have been talking, right? And clearly there is something in the water here in Portland. And if you would like us to send you some samples of Portland water just to help indoctrinate folks in other part of the country so they can equally have the same depth of trek that we share, we'd be happy to send you a liter or two. You know, just let us know if it ever comes.
I think it's like Invasion of the Body Snatcher type of thing going on.
You know, some point it's going to be like, Vermont's been good, but I really feel, honey, I want to move to Oregon. I can't explain it. And your wife's going to be like, well, I don't want to go to Oregon. Here, just drink this.
I'm going to fall asleep and wake up with pointed ears or something. You know. Oh, boy. And, of course, we definitely want to say thank you to our trifecta from Portland, of course, Eric. So thank you so much, Eric, for hanging out and Trek talking with us.
Well, I had a great time as always, and as a person who has lived in both New England and the Great Northwest, I can tell you that there is a lot of synergy between these two regions, so it does not surprise me that we all get along pretty darn well.
No, and let's not forget let's not forget Charles. He's out in Vegas, which is actually close to you guys than I am, which is pretty cool. And, of course, I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim, and I just want to say to everybody, please stay safe and be good to each other. Hailing frequencies are closed. Good night, everybody.
Hey, all.
Good night.
Live long and prosper.
Let's see what's out there. Engage.